6,000 miles, 15 states on the back roads in America in the spring of 2024. This is the Bob Davis Podcast, podcast 1136, and I'm just finishing a 60-day mega trip. I'll explain why it's a mega trip shortly throughout the southeastern and midwestern and mid-south and eventually the upper Midwest in this country, United States, in the spring of 2024. Yeah, it is finally spring, although there's a different spring in the upper Midwest than there is in the mid-south and the south. Obviously, in New York State now, finally, and even other areas south of Wisconsin and Minnesota, it is almost full on summer, but we're going to be not quite there yet. Even in early May, we have had snow in Minnesota, and people usually wait a little while till we get more temperate weather before they start working on their gardens. If you need help with your garden this season, contact GardenGurusMN.com. They sponsor this podcast, and what they do is they concentrate on helping people with the pieces of the garden that they need help with. For example, clearing bramble bush, sometimes the really hard stuff. Or if you have relatives that have had gardens and appreciate gardens but can't do them anymore, Garden Gurus is a great choice. Check them out online at GardenGurusMN.com. This is a mega trip because if you were to take this trip, which basically you go from southwestern Arizona all the way over along the Gulf Coast down to Florida, all around the tip of Florida, back up across the coastline on A1A, up into the coastal plain of Georgia and the outer islands of Georgia, on up into South Carolina and the coastal plain and some of the islands in South Carolina, further up into North Carolina and the Outer Banks, and slightly west up into Virginia, central Virginia, and then out across western Virginia and southwestern Virginia into Tennessee, up through the middle of Tennessee, turning north around Kentucky, getting into Kentucky for a brief period of time, and then on up into Illinois, around Chicago, up into Wisconsin, and then one more leg here in the next few days, heading north on 41 and then across on 8 to western Wisconsin, where I'll hole up for the next 4 or 5 months. If you did all of this on the freeways, it would be, you know, a week or two. But because nomad travel tends to be slower, because we like to spread out the expenses, so we take our time. And it isn't that I have to be anywhere, because my job is on the road making podcasts and videos and things of that nature. So it's 60 days, almost. It'll end up being almost 70 days when I get back in the first week or so of May. Even if you just went straight at it, it would still be a longer trip because the back roads are lower and slower, meaning the average speed is probably 45 miles an hour. Most of the time it's two-lane roads. Sometimes it's four-lane roads with a median in the middle, depending on what state you're in. And there's a lot of backtracking and turning, especially when I got onto the coast. I spent a lot of time and some mileage going back and forth between places I'd stay by the interstates and back out to the shoreline or the islands the next day. So that's the reason it has been a mega trip, because it's purely this pleasure of driving through small towns and driving on two-lane roads. Much of this travel is a dream. To make sure that it goes well, the traveler has to have the perspective of, you know, I'm just going to kind of go with the flow, because you're going to run into problems. I've talked about the problems in the previous podcast, part one, on this subject that I've had. You always have mechanical issues. You're driving just very slowly, and most of the time, you're the only vehicle on the road. One of the things that is a huge takeaway is I've now done this, not this particular route, although it's a similar route, but I've now done this up the East Coast, down the West Coast, across the middle of the country, all the way up to Maine, all the way down to California and Arizona, more than once. I would say I've traversed this country, especially through the middle part of the country, Iowa, you know, southern Illinois, Missouri, and so on, probably 4 or 5 times. So a lot of this is while I took new routes that I had not taken before, it's old ground in the sense that I've done it many times. So I have reference points and places that I remember well. So it's a great way to kind of take the pulse of America, life in the United States at this particular time. Also, I'm not particularly fond of travel logs, because that's the go-to type of content on YouTube for nomad travel. We stayed here, we had a hamburger here, we had great ice cream here, we went to a taffy pull here. In other words, they hit all of the attractions. These two podcasts are unusual for me because they are essentially travel logs, although I have different observations. But I don't go on trips to investigate the best hamburger places in Florida or the best beaches to visit or any of that stuff. I have other reasons for doing what I do. So we left off in Florida. You know, the takeaways for Florida is I wouldn't go to Florida in season if I could avoid it. So we'll just leave it at that. I mentioned at the end of the other podcast, there is just too much development in Florida. There are places that aren't undergoing this massive development. There's places that are much smaller towns, but there's a lot of building because they are still recovering from several hurricanes going back a few years, which is a normal part of life in Florida. I've often mentioned going to Florida as a kid, and my grandfather had a place in Palm Beach, and we'd go there and we'd stay at this little windblown sort of motel that was really a little compound of stay in and cook in apartments. So you had two rooms, a living room, not a big living room, but you had a living room, and you had a kitchen and a little dinette area and some places to sit. What today would be thought of as an Airbnb, and it was built with cinder block and stucco. And I don't know how old it was, but it was. There was that place, there was a dinner club down the road on A1A, and you could walk across A1A at any time of the day. There was very little traffic, and this was in season. So Florida has changed drastically since those days, all over the place. I remember the only attraction of Sarasota and Clearwater was the glass-bottomed boats that they had. I don't remember going on them, but I remember all the billboards. So Florida, especially the west coast of Florida, has become very populated, and it is impossible during the season. If you have to go to Florida, or if you decide to take a vacation to Florida in season, you're going to pay through the nose. And then, of course, because there are so many people traversing the state, Florida is real bitchy about overnighting in any kind of a parking lot, Walmart, Cracker Barrel, and I talked a little bit about that. Once I got up onto the East Coast along A1A, at some point, I think I was trying to go around St. Augustine, and it got dark, and I decided to try to find a campground, and I found a campground that the little office was closed. And I'm sure if you've traveled and you've gone camping, you get there late and the office is closed. In national parks, you have to have reservations. In state forests, you usually just drive in and go around and look and see if there's an open spot. You pull in and then you go register and put it in the box, or you get up the next day and take care of it. That's usually what people do. It's a common thing. So I pulled in. It was a Florida state park, and there was nobody in the little kiosk, so I drove around and found a campsite that had no notes on it, so it didn't look like it was reserved, and I pulled in there. And I went down and talked to the camp host, and the camp host said, I'm going to make an executive decision. You just go ahead and pull in there, and then get up in the morning and go talk to the rangers. Well, at about 1:30, the ranger, who was not very nice, banged on my door. It was all upset and jacked up because I was in there. And I tried to explain to him, listen, I didn't just come in here and park. I went and talked to a a camp host, and she could have told me to leave, but she didn't. It wasn't that big of a deal. She just decided to let me go in there. And he just had a fit. And, you know, well, you got to leave. And it was pitch black, and I couldn't get out of there. And he's chasing me around, screaming at me that I have to leave again. And finally, I said, listen, you're going to have to lead me out. And he was none too happy about that. Oh, yeah. And then he took pictures of Mobile Podcast Command, which is my vehicle, so that everyone could know. We have to let everybody know what kind of a person you are. It was ridiculous. And thank you to the Florida State Park System for the free publicity for Mobile Podcast Command, since the logo and the name are on the truck. So if you're seeing the picture in a Florida State Park, thank you. As I said in the previous podcast, my destination was Sarasota because we had a family event. So let's talk about the rest of the trip after the wedding, notwithstanding some of the great places along the panhandle up at the top of the Gulf Coast of Florida, which are sparsely populated and are more country-type places. So after the wedding, I ended up going down to Marco Island briefly and then got out of there and finally found an empty part of Florida, which is literally going down 41 through the Everglades and then back up through the middle part of Florida, just south of Orlando, and cutting over to get on A1A all the way up to Cocoa Beach and north of there. If you're thinking about visiting St. Augustine at some point in your travels in season in Florida, you can forget about it because you will not find a place to park. The traffic is worse than New York City, and I don't know how they can manage it or change it at all. It's just there's too many people down there in season. If you want to go see those places, it's probably better to go ahead and go during the off season, during the summer. For example, it took me 4 hours to go literally 10 miles on Anna Maria Island. It took me hours to get through Naples on the way down to Marco Island. But later, heading north, much of that part of the trip was like a dream on the full moon to see what's been preserved by national seashores in northern Florida, north of Jacksonville and north of St. Augustine. There are a ton of beautiful national beaches and national seashores there that are literally deserted. Now, you can't camp there, but you can walk along the beach, and for Florida to have these empty beaches is really something. So we'll close the book on Florida. It's much better in the summer when no one's there. Let's just put it that way. Yeah, it's hot, but who cares? So somewhere up there in northern Florida, I pass into Georgia. St. Simons, Cumberland National, seashore all along there, and these are beautiful. I spent a lot of time going back and forth to the highway, as I said, to stay and then back out to these different islands. What was I doing? Well, I was going to truck stops. And I have a schedule when I travel. Even though it took 2 months, I had plans and places to go. So I really was focused on getting out into these islands. One of the places I went was Jekyll Island, which is the home of the Federal Reserve, or the birthplace of the Federal Reserve. And Jekyll Island is really kind of a very interesting place. There's a lot of really old history there. I didn't go west in Georgia. I just kept going up along the coastline into South Carolina. Georgia takeaways. The coastline and outer islands in Georgia are a must. There's lots of state parks and national seashore that's, you know, really beautiful, although it is hard to get campsites in season. Jekyll Island and St. Simons are pretty much the center for a lot of these other places along the national seashore that are really worth visiting. And I think it's important that the government has preserved some of these areas, because I can tell you it would be a disaster of development if not for the national seashores. One of the cool places that tells you a lot about history on, I think it's Jekyll Island, was the Horton House. This is a typical sort of colonial plantation house that is made of something called tabby, which is why it still stands literally perfectly. Now, the siding is off of it, and the rooms are gone, and the floors are gone, but the house itself is still there, because tabby is a type of concrete made by burning oyster shells to create lime. Then they mix it with water, sand, ash, and broken oyster shells, This was used by early Spanish settlers in present-day Florida, and then by British colonists primarily in coastal South Carolina and Georgia. And I guess it's a man-made analog of coquina, a naturally occurring sedimentary rock derived from shells, and it's also used for building. Really cool place. I wish, I would love to see if you could build something like that. Well, one of the things about the trip was that I was in a lot of truck stops, and I try to find the independent refueling stations. You will see a lot of those on back roads, and they always have a better deal, especially on diesel. And of course, my go-to refueling station that's independently owned is 36 Lynn, which is at 36th Street South and Lindale Avenue South in South Minneapolis in the Lynn Lake neighborhood. They're down with the community. They always have been since the first time they opened, but they're making waves with great locally sourced food in the store. They also have a great Instagram feed at 36 Lynn, if you want to check it out, because it tells you a little bit about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And one of the recent videos that they made was really cool, because one of the customers was saying, you know, it really does feel like a community in here. Check the place out. It's great. 36 Lynn, and thanks, guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, Georgia seems almost like an afterthought when you get into South Carolina and you stay on the coastline as much as you can. So I worked around Savannah. I don't remember going through Savannah. I may have, but I worked my way up through the coast. Hilton Head, and there's some great dusty beach towns along there, and I'm not going to name them, but it's in the Beaufort area along Route 21 near and around Parris Island. All along the seashore down through the Hilton Head Island area all the way up to Charleston, went around it and went along the Francis Marion National Forest and then the preserved coastline of Cape Romaine National Wildlife Reserve, all along up to Georgetown, almost all the way up to Myrtle Beach and into North Carolina. Myrtle Beach, I had a little bit better impression of Myrtle Beach since the last time I was there, but a lot of these places, the further north you go, both North and South Carolina, you get into resorts, and of course you get into traffic in season. The only saving grace is in season, those areas are not as warm as Southern Florida. So they're warmer than Chicago in December, but I wouldn't necessarily want to take a trip to the Outer Banks in December, because you will not get the same sort of tropical experience that you get when you're in South Florida during season. South Carolina takeaways. What I like to do is hit these coastal areas in the eastern states when I'm in the east looking for unique beach towns. And I found several that were really great, and I'm not going to name them again because I don't want to ruin them. I'm just going to say that if you're looking for sort of an old school stay in a less active place and you can hit the weather right, so a little bit towards the end of the season, I was there in early, I guess it was early April at that point. Well, then I went up to North Carolina. Again, driving all along the coastal plain here, navigating on all those little squirrely roads along the coastal plain. So we're talking about 179 through all these places, Ocean Isle Beach, Oak Island, on out to the Carolina beaches in the Outer Banks. Carolina Beach, sometimes you have to go back into the inner parts of the swamp, so to speak, to get back out onto the coastal highways or take ferries. I love the ferries. They have some free ferries or very nominal charges for the ferries. Emerald Island, Atlantic Beach, all along the Outer Banks. The ferry to Ocracoke is essentially an official rest area. So you can pull up in there late at night and you can wait for the morning ferry and you can just hang out there. And so those areas are really great. Ocracoke Island is historic. There's a couple of different National Seashore campgrounds there, and usually they have spots, and it is beautiful. The beaches are incredible, and it was warm too. The last time I was on Ocracoke, it was I think it was in February of like 2020 and 2021, and it was raw. It was really cold and rainy, and it wasn't pleasant. And this time it was really beautiful. So then 12 runs all along those Outer Banks, and you could take them all the way up to Kitty Hawk if you dare. Once you get there, there's a point there where you can cut off and turn up to 64. to head up to Virginia from North Carolina. And I'm not talking about Interstate 64. I'm talking about Highway 64. And I turned, I've been to Kitty Hawk, and it's the saddest thing ever. And I talked about it in, I don't know when, a couple other podcasts. Kitty Hawk is where, obviously, the first flight in America took place. And they wouldn't be able to do it now if they wanted to, because there is a gated community directly across and a big white fence so that you can't see it because there's a McDonald's on the other side of the fence. It's really unfortunate because that whole area, I'm sure, was quite beautiful when in 1910 or 1904 or whatever, I can't remember when the first flight was. I think it was around the early part of the 20th century when they took off from this hill. They had these wooden tracks that went down the hill. You wouldn't be able to do it today because the tracks went all the way down to the beach. The National Seashore and the remoteness of these islands, they're way off the coast. Ocracoke is pretty far off the coast, and if you take a ferry, you'll be out on the water for quite some time. But it's the National Seashores along Ocracoke especially that keep these areas from being overdeveloped. Some of the Outer Banks where development has ravaged, you can't even see the beach, but as I said, most of that is up on the north part of the Outer Banks. And all of this is part of the Cape Hatteras National Seashore. So the Outer Banks in North Carolina are pretty far out in Pamlico Sound in the Atlantic Ocean, so it's really interesting, the history there. Again, I discovered a lot of history, especially Civil War history and Revolutionary War history in that area as well. I think it'd be great to go there in the summer, too. Let's move on to Virginia. So part of the schedule for this trip was that I was due to meet some people to clear out my mom's storage area. She passed away exactly 3 years ago. I was on the schedule to get to Virginia, get to Richmond, the Richmond area, to clear out a bunch of stuff for my mom's storage area and close it down. So I had some movers that were coming, and that had to be a certain date. So it's kind of fun to tack to a date as long as you're not overtaxed to get there. I was in west of the Richmond area during the eclipse at that time, and that was amazing. I lived in Virginia, I lived in Richmond, I lived in the Washington, D.C. area for about 10 years, and also down in Richmond. Richmond and its environs, all of Virginia really, is just chock full of Civil War history and Revolutionary War history. So after I left the Richmond area, I headed out 460 to Bristol, Virginia, way down in the southwestern corner of the Virginia border area by West Virginia and the north side of Kentucky and Tennessee on the south side. I went to Bristol because I wanted to do a podcast about the history of country music, as you know, and the birthplace of country music museum, and the birthplace of country music is in fact Bristol, Virginia, not Tennessee, but Bristol, Virginia. Nashville is where the Country Music Hall of Fame is, and that is sort of the recording center of country music. But it all pretty much started in Bristol, and I did a podcast about it if you want to hear more about it. I actually prefer the western part of Virginia. Blacksburg is a wonderful town. Lynchburg is a wonderful town. Radford is a wonderful town. Roanoke is a really nice little town. And of course, so is Bristol. They're all kind of a little mountainy. They're very well populated and usually pretty busy, and that's kind of nice. And I recommend Bristol, Virginia as well for people to visit for a lot of reasons. There's a country music school. Well, it's a music school that specializes in bluegrass there. They have a lot of music festivals in Bristol, and it's great back roads in the Old Dominion. Really great roads in Virginia. Franklin, Tennessee is where my friend John Holland lives, and that was my objective. And the big takeaway here is Tennessee is, for me, this time, was all about navigating. I have really enjoyed using maps and navigating using maps. And you tend to pull over more and look at the map, and you have to look at a map until a route emerges. It's kind of like looking at a piece of modern art. If you stare at it long enough, eventually you will see a perfect route to get from where you are to where you want to be. And that's one of my favorite things about travel this way. again, I think the accepted way of travel in this country now is to put a destination into your GPS, and your GPS puts you on an interstate, and you do what the GPS tells you to do for 14 hours. That is not fun for me. The juice for me is passing through these small towns. It's seeing life in places that if you're traveling on the interstate, you will never see. It's seeing how people live, how small towns are doing. Some places are more, broken down than others. Others are really prosperous. And it's always interesting to me to think about why one place is prosperous and another one isn't, or what's going on in one place versus another. What I did once I got into Tennessee was cut literally straight across the state. And so that was getting to Franklin, which is south of Brentwood and south of Nashville. And then you have Murfreesboro to the east. Real Tennessee is fading. Again, one of the issues here, and I just noticed it in the headlines, people in Tennessee are starting to get really irritated because there is so much growth in Nashville. And of course, it's running up the price of real estate. And you can't believe it. We were in Franklin. And again, it was amazing to me. So we went up to Brentwood for breakfast at one point. Here's a state that kind of invented stock car racing in Bristol and is popular because of the whole run and whiskey thing and the haulers and the mountain driving and so forth. And then you get into this place like Nashville is just booming. So you don't want to have to go through that on freeways to get to where you're going. I went straight across on back roads. If you want to see the real Tennessee, you got to get into the rural areas, into the mountains. Chattanooga is probably a better example, even though Chattanooga also was really the seat of where the development started in Tennessee many, many years ago. So for takeaways, the most interesting thing I think is probably this part of the country is really where most of the Civil War was fought. I know that the word Civil War is in the headlines these days. When you see the extent to which there was death and destruction in the middle South, the Deep South, so all the way up from Florida and Texas and Georgia and Virginia, you see these plaques everywhere that are just these little battles that were fought that probably didn't even make it in the history books, as well as the big battles where hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives, not to mention the death and destruction in these areas. And so there are the same kind of plaques all over Tennessee. It's also home to the Trail of Tears. There were a lot of Indian battles in Eastern Tennessee early on. And it was a scene of early development in the United States, especially in the eastern part of Tennessee. Kentucky, I was in Kentucky for a short period of time. Kentucky does not have shoulders on its back roads, which drives me crazy. It also makes driving in the mountains, which you do in Tennessee, kind of fun. It's a little bit of a challenge. My plan was I was going to go over to Missouri from Tennessee and see a friend that I thought lived north of St. Louis. So I contacted him, and it turned out he lived north of Kansas City, and I just thought, and I'm not going that far west because I may as well start working my way west again. And since my target is western Wisconsin, I didn't want to ping pong across the country and end up in Kansas City and have to come back up through western Iowa. I came on up through Kentucky on 51, and I just continued on 51 through southern Illinois. Well, I was born in Illinois. I have been all over Illinois, so I know Illinois pretty well. I'm from Chicago and also worked in St. Louis for a couple of years. So I've been around that state many, many times doing different trips going around Illinois. Illinois has great roads, especially in the South, because it is such a huge agricultural state. So I had tremendous navigation coming up 51 all the way up through Marion. And then all the way up to Anna. I came up 51 all the way up through Carbondale. And as I was coming up to 51, my plan was just to continue up 51 all the way up into Wisconsin. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll go see my friend Steve, who lives south of Chicago. and here again made a judgment call that turned into a brilliant piece of navigation, because I went up 37 to Effingham and then over onto 40, which angled up to Route 1, and then I took Route 1 all the way up to around Kankakee, where my friends live. Another brilliant piece of navigation, which was to take 52. 52 from the southern part of the state is an excellent way to skirt Chicago. You come up, you go around Joliet, you go through Sycamore, and you go through all these small northern farming towns until you cross the border into Wisconsin. The main thing about Illinois was it was so much fun to be on flat land after driving through mountains for 3 days. Once I had skirted Chicago, I got on 23 north and took that all the way up to Wisconsin, where I am in Neenah. 23 pretty much goes all the way up to Neenah. Most people think of Illinois, they think of Chicago. They don't think of the agricultural output of this huge state. But there is one takeaway, and that is Cairo, Illinois. I've known Cairo because Cairo, Illinois is kind of Mark Twain. It was a river center. There's a lot of other things about that town. So when I came into the town, I was shocked at the condition of this town that is so historic in Illinois. It's just falling apart. It looks like Cuba. I mean, it's shocking the degree to which the deterioration has taken hold there. So when I got to my friend's house in southern Illinois, well, they live around Kankakee and south of Chicago, and I said to Darlene, Steve's wife, I was like, what happened to Cairo? And she goes, oh, well, the wonderful governor of Illinois, she doesn't like Pritzker, she goes, he outlawed fracking, and they passed a law, and you can't frack. Unbeknownst to me, fracking is bringing back portions of Indiana. It's also bringing back portions of Pennsylvania, and it would have brought portions of southern Illinois back if Illinois had not outlawed fracking, and that is what has happened to Cairo, Illinois. If you're a photographer, you need to get there and take some pictures. It is really shocking, but at the same time, there's some incredible images available in that town that is literally decaying before our eyes, and it's sad. What can I say about Wisconsin? I came straight up through Wisconsin to Neenah. Wisconsin is vibrant. It's this part of Wisconsin is a vibrant industrial and business corridor. Neenah itself is an old paper mill town. The Fox River runs high and strong, and so hydroelectricity is a big deal around here, and hydroelectric power is the main reason that this area developed as much as it did industrially, because the river hydroelectric plants produced a surfeit of electricity all along this area, all along this corridor, north from Milwaukee, Milwaukee as well because of the lake and the river, and then of course Appleton, Oshkosh, Green Bay, Neenah, and a bunch of other towns that were manufacturing towns, both ironworks and in all other kinds of business. And they have a little place here called Future Neenah, which is a nonprofit, which has completely redeveloped and turned the downtown into kind of a show place as well. And then, of course, this is the home of the EAA Air Show, which I have come to many times, and which, of course, John Holland has also come to many times. John actually piloted a B-17 off that runway at one point many, many years ago. So it's pretty cool. Well, I'm sure there are going to be things that come up from this trip many times in podcasts, and I will probably do yet another podcast with kind of some other takeaways from this trip. I actually thought it was 3,500 miles, but it was 6,000 miles and 15 states. So Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, South Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, Illinois, Wisconsin. That's 15 states. So 6,000 miles, 15 states in the spring of 2024 in America. Podcast 1136, the Bob Davis Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Come to decide that the things that I tried were in my life just to get high on. when I sit alone. Come get a little known, but I need more than myself this time. Step from the road to the sea to the sky, and I do believe that we rely on. When I lay it on, come get to play it on. All my life to sacrifice. Hey.